called Tried and Convicted, How Police, Prosecutors, and Judges Destroy Our Constitutional Rights. As you can fairly tell from that very firmly worded title and subtitle, Michael Cecchini has grave concerns about the way in which our criminal justice system plays out, and in particular, some of the ways in which what he regards as bedrock constitutional rights that we all have are on a fairly regular basis trampled and manipulated in the cause of bringing criminals to justice. And sometimes what ends up happening, of course, is a rush to judgment and a conviction of persons who, in fact, are innocent. But even beyond that is the problem of our own constitutional rights being trivialized, sometimes utterly ignored by the criminal justice system designed to safeguard those rights. And that is what Mr. Cecchini is exploring in this very compelling book published by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. Again, the title, Tried and Convicted, How Police, Prosecutors, and Judges Destroy Our Constitutional Rights. And I'm very pleased to be speaking with Michael Cecchini for the next few minutes about his book. Michael Cecchini, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
You tell a story very early in the book about a moment when you found yourself more troubled than you had ever been troubled before when it comes to this issue of our constitutional rights being ignored. It was the spring of 2008, and a court case that, of course, made headlines all over the state and indeed beyond the borders of our state. Remind our listeners of the trial that occurred at that point and then what was so troubling to you.
Sure. There was a homicide case in Kenosha about a poisoning. And what happened is that there was a so-called letter from the grave. The person who had died had written a letter ahead of time saying that if I died, my husband would have done it. And after she died, this letter came out, and the issue in the court case was, well, can this letter come forward? And the prosecutor wanted to use it to convict the defendant, and the defendant said, well, no, I have a right to confront or cross-examine my accusers. I can't do that. I can't cross-examine the accusations in here, and I can't cross-examine the accuser. And the case went up on a special appeal and went from the trial court to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and Justice Butler was on the court at the time, and all the other justices said, well, yes, because he's accused, we can find him, we can assume he's guilty, and because he's guilty, he forfeited his right to confront the accuser and the letter, and therefore we'll let it in. And Justice Butler said, wait a minute, this is nonsense. We can't be expanding this doctrine like this. We can't assume a person is guilty to then assume that he's forfeited his right to then let the letter in by which he will be convicted. It was a very circular argument, and he was highly criticized for that. When he ran for re-election, we elect our Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin. When he ran for re-election, there was an independent ad run in favor of his opponent, and they were criticizing him for using what was a technicality to free a guilty person. Well, the person was ultimately convicted. That was very upsetting to me because the Constitution, especially the right of confrontation, is not a technicality. You can imagine how we've heard the phrase, talk is cheap. Anyone can say anything, and if anyone is allowed to go up and repeat that or read someone's prior statements without the ability to cross-examine that letter or that statement or that person, how much faith can we really have in the outcome of the trial? Now, it turns out that Justice Butler was actually vindicated later. Our Supreme Court said, our United States Supreme Court said, no, that was wrong. That was the wrong decision. We can't assume a person is guilty to conclude he forfeited his right of confrontation and then let him be convicted by the very piece of evidence that came into evidence. Justice Butler was right about that. He was defeated in his election, unfortunately, in my opinion. But that's something that really didn't sit well with me, especially when these advertisements for justice that was running against Justice Butler was just trivializing our Constitution beyond belief.
Right.
The right of confrontation is not a trivial matter. And in fact, it's hard to get to the truth of what happened without confronting allegations. That's the central part of the criminal process. If we cannot confront or cross-examine, how can we actually get to the truth? How can we expose a person's motives? How can we expose the inaccuracies of their statement? And that's a fundamental right that's far from any type of technicality. And that was very unsettling to me. And that's, I think, what you're referring to is the introduction of the book. And that's what I wrote about in that part.
Right. And not to retry that case or spend too much time on this specific matter, but I mean, although it's very, very interesting and obviously crucial to you being galvanized to explore this further and to write this very thought-provoking book. One of the things that I think is important to say is that it's probably even possible to have some disagreement over this, in the sense that, I mean, I think it was argued forcibly by the prosecuting attorney, I think it was Mr. Jamboys, that, I mean, of course you can't confront this person because you killed them. I mean, that was the contention.
Right.
And of course, you're talking about a circular argument that really does make this complicated. But I think what you're saying, kind of beyond the specifics, is the attitude with which this was addressed, particularly by the media and particularly by these political ads.
Right.
Making it sound, I mean, it's one thing to maybe disregard this with a sense of momentousness, like, in some ways, we shouldn't do this, but we feel compelled to do this, or,
right,
you know, for whatever reason, versus this is a technicality, this really doesn't matter, why don't we just flush this away anyway, it just gets in the way. I mean, that sort of cavalier attitude, in some respects, it seems like that's what bothered you the most, and it seems to me just about any intelligent person should be able to agree with you when it comes to that. I mean, even if on the specific instance in this trial,
right,
we might disagree.
Right, and that's a great point. So often, people that I talk to, or even people that on juries, when we get to question them about things, the attitude sometimes toward it's as if a colleague of mine once said that if someone else is accused, we presume them guilty, and the Constitution is a mere technicality. But when the day comes that we're accused, then we want the full smorgasbord of constitutional rights. People don't realize how easy it is. For example, when we're selecting a jury, and we get a whole panel of people we're questioning, a lot of times I don't think a lot of people realize how easy it is. Instead of sitting there in the jury pool being selected for a jury, they could easily be sitting next to me being accused of a crime. So it's just our criminal justice system has expanded so broadly today that it's so easy to be accused that these rights are extremely important. And that's one of the things I wanted to get across in the book, is that they protect all of us. They don't just protect the one or two people who are accused of crimes that happen to make the news. These are rights that protect all of us on a day in and day out basis. So they're very important, and it's in all of our interests to have strong constitutional protections.
Hmm. We're speaking with Michael D. Cicchini, a criminal defense lawyer here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, the author of a book called Tried and Convicted, How Police, Prosecutors, and Judges Destroy Our Constitutional Rights. One of the most important points you make, which needs to be understood right off the bat, is a distinction between hard laws and soft laws. Explain this distinction and why it is so crucial to understanding what your concerns are about our criminal justice system.
Sure, and I'll use an example that I used in the book where it can incorporate both what I call a hard law and a soft law. Let's suppose there's a young man, say 17 years old, goes to a party, meets a young lady there, and there is some physical contact, and then the next day the police arrive at his door, and they come up to him and they make an allegation. They say, hey, you've been accused of forcibly raping someone. We want to talk to you about it. And he instantly says, well, wait a minute. You know, I didn't rape anyone. That was completely consensual. Well, if it turns out that person with whom he had the sexual contact was underage, he is now, let's say, 16. The police just lied to him about what they were investigating. They were never investigating a forcible rape in the first place. What they did is they just got an unknowing or an unwitting admission to a crime. What people commonly think of as statutory rape. And this depends greatly on the state and the different laws. This varies, you know, the ages and things can vary from state to state. Now, in some states, including Wisconsin, that sexual assault law is a hard law, meaning in the sense that it doesn't matter if the person lied to him about his age, about her age, his or her age. It doesn't matter if the person had a fake identification card. The law says that if you have sexual contact with a person under a certain age, whether you knew it or not, whether you were lied to, whether you had reason to believe it or not, that's a hard law. You're going down. You've just confessed to a crime, and there's no defense to it. You cannot defend that you were mistaken or that the person misrepresented the age. So a lot of the criminal laws are very hard laws. Another way of saying it is like a strict liability law. The law doesn't allow you to defend on certain bases. Now, in some states, you can. Some states, you can say, I was deceived. I had reason to believe the person was of age. But other states, you cannot. And that's what a hard law is. There are no ifs, ands about it. Contrast that with a soft law. The example I use in the book is the person who was just duped by the police and was being interrogated. We all know about Miranda rights, where the police have to read us our rights to remain silent, right to an attorney, things of that nature. They have to inform us of these. Now, a lot of people come into my office and they complain the police didn't do that. They didn't read me my rights. Well, the law, first of all, is written very much in favor of the police. They only have to inform a person of their Miranda rights if two things are present. One, they are in custody or arrested, and two, they're being questioned or interrogated. Now, in the example I give in the book, the police went up to the person's home, made that accusation to them, and they got a response, which they then can use to prosecute him for a serious felony, the sexual assault of a child law. Now, because the person was not in custody at the time, the police didn't have to read him his rights. So it's a soft law. There's flexibility. There's ways police can get around it. They can get statements. They can get confessions without reading a person their rights. And even if the police are in a situation where they have to read someone their rights, for example, they have to arrest them and then start formally questioning him or her, then they have ways to induce a waiver. It's a very soft, flexible system. The police are given a lot of leeway. That stands in stark contrast to the criminal law, the sexual assault of a child law, where there are no defenses in many states, and there are no ways around it. Whereas a soft law, the constitutional protection or having your Miranda rights read to you, that's very flexible. It allows a lot of leeway. It allows the police room to manipulate things. And even if things don't go well for them, manipulation can continue by the prosecutors and the judges into the courtroom when they can make certain findings as to whether a person their statement was voluntary or whether the police were required to read them their rights and didn't and things of that nature. So there's a lot of flexibility and the laws are manipulated when it comes to our constitutional protections. On the other side, some of the criminal laws are very hard and inflexible.
Hmm. Or your words, I think, as you first describe it, is they are clear-cut and immutable.
Yeah, that's I write better than I speak, I'm afraid. That's a great that's a great way of saying it. I think it captures it a lot better. And it is. And in Wisconsin, it's such a case. We had a case here where a person had sexual contact with a young man had sexual contact with with a younger person. I don't even know if the victim in that case was a man or a woman, but it turns out the person was underage, had shown the defendant a state-issued identification card, and the defendant had other reason to believe the person was of age. It turns out it was all fake, a fraud, and the court would not let him defend on those bases, and he was therefore convicted. So that's very immutable, to say the least.
Hmm. And I guess in some ways the heart and soul of this, of your concern and the writing of this book, is the fact that that the one kind of law is clear-cut and immutable, and then the other is so soft and spongy and flexible, and typically it is bent to the disadvantage of the person who is being accused. And the fact that we're talking about such disparate kinds of laws when, in fact, you believe constitutional protections of the individual should be just as clear-cut and firm as the actual criminal laws.
That's right. It's hardly a fair fight. We've got, on the one hand, the trained police officers, prosecutors, and they have tremendous flexibility with which to work. And then on the other hand, we have often completely unsuspecting defendants who may think they have constitutional rights, and often they're just completely bypassed, sidestepped, and in some cases just flat-out destroyed.
We're speaking with Michael Cecchini about his book, Tried and Convicted, How Police, Prosecutors, and Judges Destroy Our Constitutional Rights. Before we explore a couple of specific concerns, I think it would be interesting to touch on something else in the book of a bit more personal nature, that is your own background. you are in some respects kind of a latecomer to the practice of law. I mean, not a latecomer, I guess, but it's not the first thing that you did professionally. And as you entered this world, you really experienced some dismay almost right away, particularly in the way there was sort of unexpected echoes with some of what you had done before. Can you talk a moment about that?
Sure. Yeah, I started out in business. You know, I studied at UW Parkside and graduate school at Marquette, and got a CPA, and I worked in various business jobs, but I never really found those completely satisfying. Some of the work was interesting, but it just wasn't my thing. I went to law school, and I really loved law school, and when I got out, I went into a big firm thinking I would do business law-related type things, maybe tax law, things of that nature, and I found a lot of similarities in that environment to the jobs that I had left, in the business environment. They were very similar, so it was a bit unfulfilling. And what I did at that point is I just decided, I think of the options that are out there for me. After a couple years at a big firm, I decided to hang out my shingle, do my own thing, set up my own practice. And that was about almost 11 years ago now, and I've been doing that ever since. And I didn't intend to do it to get into criminal law. As I state in the book, I was almost kind of a Republican or right-leaning, but I certainly didn't have any social causes that I was advancing, and I wasn't very political in any sense of the word. And I got into doing some criminal defense law just to get some experience, maybe to get into the courtroom. I thought if I was lucky, maybe I'd get a jury trial and get some experience in the courtroom, and I could use that in other practice areas. And once I started taking my first criminal cases, I haven't done anything since. And that's been, like I said, almost 11 years now, because the things I saw were just so surprising. You learn about a constitutional right in law school, but then when you see how it actually works in the real world, how that is applied and how it's abused and manipulated and the different things that go on in the criminal system, it was incredibly interesting. Incredibly frustrating, I just could never get out of the practice of law, and here I am 11 years later.
Right. Let's examine a couple of the specific concerns that you explore in great thoroughness in your book. And, of course, one of the most important is this whole notion of self-incrimination, which, of course, runs in tandem with the Miranda rights that we have, that we know to some extent from television and film and so on. Among the things you discuss here is the fact that often people are disclosing information about themselves and their own guilt at a time when, technically speaking, they are not protected by their Miranda rights. That is, when a police officer shows up at your door investigating something. At that point, you are not in custody, and they don't have to read you your Miranda rights. What is your concern here? Do you wish that Miranda rights were expanded to include these kind of exchanges, or otherwise, what is going wrong in this particular instance?
Sure. Well, and there's a little bit of a distinction there. You always have the rights. The rights are always there with you. The key is, when do the police have to technically advise you of those rights? And that's an important distinction.
Oh, I see. First, just to clarify.
Sure.
So when those police officers show up at your doorstep, you have the right to remain silent, but the police are not compelled to tell you you have the right to remain silent.
That's right. It's all about, and what I write about in the book, and this is one of the reasons why I put in the book that it's not a book for legal advice. It's not designed for that, because there are so many complexities and nuances. What I focus on is, when must the police read a person their right to remain silent? When must they inform him of that right, including the right to an attorney and what's commonly called the Miranda right? So absolutely, that's an important distinction. That's what I focus on in the book. You know, my bigger problem with Miranda is there's some of the other abuses. For example, the police can, another tactic, that's the question first, arrest second tactic. Another tactic that's been in published cases, even here in Wisconsin and certainly throughout the country, is to arrest first, and then don't question but make statements. For example, they may arrest a person, take him into custody. Instead of formally questioning him, they may say, they just may start making statements to the person. Hey, you've been accused of forcible rape. Well, the police then later can claim, well, that wasn't a question, I wasn't questioning him, when they know full well that will elicit a response. For example, a denial, I didn't rape the person, it was consensual. Then they get what they need, the statement to the sexual contact for the strict liability crime. So there's multiple variations on that. Another, my big problem is when the police do have to read rights, the way that they can induce a person to waive those rights. That's my biggest concern is, and I've written some articles on this as well, when the police arrest and are questioning someone and they read them their rights, the most alarming thing is the things they can say and do to get them to waive those rights. They can essentially tell the person that talking will be there to their benefit. Their statement can be used for or against them in court, which is not true. It's the rarest of cases where a person can introduce their own statement in court in their own defense. They may, in some instances, threaten them with incarceration if they don't speak, with their family. They can threaten their family. They can do any number of things. And courts are extremely tolerant to this kind of behavior. That's the most alarming thing. So the thing, the first instance, I don't know if Miranda should be extended or not to when the police talk to someone out of custody. Miranda was designed to protect people from the inherently coercive nature of the police station. In other words, when you're down there at the police station. But that raises another tactic. Sometimes the police simply say, "Hey, you know, we're investigating something. You might be able to give us some information. We'd like you to come down to the police station." Next thing you know, it's the old bait and switch. You're brought into the police station, a small interrogation room, and now you are the target of a crime or of an investigation. A lot of people don't know that they can just walk out at that time. They don't feel like they can just leave freely, but yet the police say, well, they weren't under arrest. They came down voluntarily. So the abuses in this area are just so great. I think that the least of the abuses is when they walk up to someone on the street or in their home and just start conversing with them. It may seem extreme, and I think it's a very effective tactic for law enforcement, but with what goes on in the police stations and the interrogation rooms, it's actually the least of the problems.
Mm. You also devote an entire chapter to the matter of privacy, and after kind of discussing what often occurs, you say it becomes painfully evident that yet another of our constitutional rights is a soft law. The right of privacy is mere putty in the hands of police and later of prosecutors and judges in the courtroom. What is the most pervasive sort of damage done to our rights of privacy in the criminal justice system?
Sure. Well, the right of privacy, and maybe I'll just give a brief explanation of how this works for listeners who aren't familiar with it. Typically, let's say I use the example in the book of a marijuana cigarette, which is by far the most common type of contraband and creates a huge amount of criminal cases throughout the country. Let's say the police come into a person's home. They don't have a warrant. They don't have any basis or reason to be there other than mere suspicion or, you know, just mere suspicion. Let's leave it at that. They come in. They find a marijuana cigarette. The person is prosecuted for a crime, which can often be a felony. In fact, in Wisconsin, certain simple possession crimes of marijuana can be a felony if the person has a prior such offense or a prior drug-related crime. But in any case, the way it works is that if the person is prosecuted, they or their lawyer would then bring a motion to suppress or keep out that evidence. They would say, hey, the police had no business being in my home. They violated my constitutional rights. They therefore cannot use their illegal actions and then use the evidence obtained from it. So you have to suppress this evidence, this marijuana cigarette. Now, then we have a hearing in court, and this is kind of the framework where all this takes place. And what happens then, the police can simply say after the fact that, well, you know, we heard noises inside the house. We thought someone was in danger. Therefore, we had no choice but to enter. Once we entered, we saw the marijuana cigarette. Now, that's called the exigent circumstances exception. The police can essentially come up with an explanation after the fact that they had some reason to believe that there was some type of exigency, and then use that as a basis to enter the home. There are numerous exceptions to the warrant requirement that can permit the police to enter the home, or once they're in the home, if they're invited into the home, there are numerous exceptions that allow them additional access into other parts of the home. It's often been called the Swiss cheese rule because there's so many holes in it, the right of privacy. So that is a huge problem. And a lot of people say, well, Who cares if the person had a marijuana cigarette in the house or whatever the contraband was? They don't have a right to privacy. Well, therein lies the problem. In order for the Constitution to protect any of us, it has to protect all of us. If the police just decide to do random searches and find contraband in 1 out of 10 homes, well, guess what? The other 9 people were innocent. They had their constitutional rights violated, and they will again and again in the future. So the Constitution, we can't look at it in that regard. We have to look at it up front and say, look, this is something that has to protect all of us. So when a police violate a constitutional right, you know, that evidence shouldn't come in. But unfortunately, there's so many exceptions and loopholes. The right of privacy has been decimated, in my opinion.
Another very pervasive problem, and it's to the extent that we scarcely even think of it as a problem anymore or as something that shouldn't exist, is the matter of the speedy trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has become such the norm to not receive a speedy trial that seems like the new normal, and one scarcely feels like complaining about such a thing. And yet, this is a serious matter, and again, someone's constitutional rights are being disregarded in this case.
That's right. There are numerous different speedy trial rights. One I focus on is the constitutional right to a speedy trial, and what happens is a lot of these criminal cases that we have drag on. I have several that are now past the point of a year, or certainly will be by the time of trial. Others can go a couple years, and some have gone even longer. And the laws, you know, the Constitution says we have a right to a speedy trial because that's a tremendous. First of all, a lot of people are held in custody while they're awaiting trial if they're not able to post their cash bail that's been set. But second of all, even if that's not the case, these cases can clog up the court system. There's a tremendous amount of anxiety for most people when they're charged with a crime. And what the speedy trial happens, if a defendant raises that challenge and says, look, Judge, I've been here for 2 or 3 years now, and I still haven't been able to get into court and get my trial, the court, it's a very soft law. You brought up that distinction before of a hard law versus a soft law. This constitutional right to a speedy trial is a very soft law, and the judge will look at 4 factors. Well, what's the reason for the delay? The judge may say, well, it's true this delay was caused by the prosecutor, but he didn't cause it intentionally. He was merely negligent in not getting witnesses or not getting his case ready for trial, so mere negligence won't be weighed heavily against him, so that's not that big of a deal. They may say, well, there's been no prejudice, even though the defendant can't sleep and is constantly worried and is suffering health problems. He's not been incarcerated, so there's no real prejudice to him. They may say, well, the length of the delay has only been 2 years. That's not uncommonly long, so we're not going to grant this motion to dismiss. Your constitutional right has not been violated. When we set up these different factors that are so flexible and allow a judge to hang on any one of them to say that the right to a speedy trial has not been violated, that's normally what happens. I think there's only been a small handful of cases, 2 to 3 that I'm aware of in Wisconsin, where that speedy trial right has ever been deemed to be violated. Some cases on a national level and federally can go 3, 4 or more years. So once again, it's a constitutional right that most people think, yeah, I should get that trial in 4 months, 6 months, certainly within a year. It often doesn't happen.
Hmm. In your book, you explore the matter of judicial bias, of sometimes bias being very evident and present in juries. And in Chapter 12 of the book, you explore one of the murkiest, messiest matters of all, namely that of plea bargaining.
Mm.
And, of course, part of what's happening in the typical case of plea bargaining is something that is not really occurring in the courtroom, that is the formation or the crafting of a plea bargain, not in the light of day of a courtroom, but behind closed doors. And that right there seems to make it a very different sort of matter and rife with the possibility of corruption, I suppose.
Well, in that case, in the case of plea bargaining, and that's, by the way, almost all criminal cases are resolved that way. About 95% probably is a good number. It varies by community and by state, of course. We have a local judge here, Judge Schrader, who is not fond of the plea bargaining system. And in my book, I expose a lot of the problems with it. One of the problems is that the law these days allows the prosecutor to charge for a single act. I give an example of the book where a mother and a son and a husband get into a family dispute, and the mother grabs the son by the arm and ultimately is charged with 4 crimes. Now, this is not exaggerated. What I try and do in the book is come up with the common common types of cases that are clogging up our court system. The murder case, the armed robbery, these are the rare cases. The more common cases are cases like the one I just described. And in that example, the mother was charged with four crimes: a disorderly conduct, a false imprisonment, a child abuse, and dissuading a victim from reporting, all for, you know, grabbing someone by the arm. So allowing a prosecutor to charge so many different counts for one single act puts a defendant at a huge disadvantage at plea bargaining. In many cases, it almost guarantees the prosecutor the ability to get a conviction, because they place the defendant in a position, look, we'll dismiss two or three of these counts. You plead to one, that'll cut your potential exposure, because if you go to trial and you're convicted, you could get consecutive sentences for all these. So plea bargaining is skewed from the get-go, and the law, it's another example when a plea bargain is struck. It's another example of a soft law. There's so many ways for prosecutors to get out of their plea bargains that they make once they make them that, as I say in the book, if you're a defendant negotiating with your very freedom and liberty, you have fewer contractual rights than if you were to just go to a store and buy a product. Because a plea bargain is essentially a contract. It's an agreement between the state acting through the prosecutor and the defendant. And it's just rife with possibilities for manipulation and abuse. And, you know, I give several examples of that in the book as well.
Right. In the minute or so that remains, you are raising these concerns at a time when the tide of public opinion seems to really be sweeping in the other direction. That is, the predominant attitude of the country seems to be about cracking down on criminals more than safeguarding their constitutional rights. What do you foresee as the possibility of some progress being made in the areas about which you have such grave concerns?
Well, I do offer some suggestions for reform in the last chapter, but, you know, you're right. With the culture today, it's a very hyper-vigilant anti-crime culture. And one of the problems, though, is we've defined crime so broadly. As I say in one of the chapters, I give several examples. We're sucking people into the criminal system, and they're shocked to learn that what they've been accused of and what they've done is even criminal. Our media always has a war on crime going. So the thing you describe, I certainly agree with. I think it's been going on for some time. Our media-driven culture is always focusing on a war on some crime, whether it's drugs or terror, and it gives the impression that serious violent crime, you know, is the norm. And what I'm trying to do is show that, you know, it's not the exception. It's not the norm. It's the exception. The most crimes that clog up our court system don't involve any harm to people, don't involve any property damage, things of that nature. I think a better approach, is there any hope for reform? I think if there is, the key is this. Our tough on crime crusade, and again, I'm not talking about violent crime and people who pose a risk to society. I'm just talking about the typical types of crimes that are ground through our court systems. Our tough on crime crusade costs a lot of money. I think the key is, especially in these times of strained budget crises, we need to realize how much money we're spending on this. A great example is California's, I call the budget crippling, three strikes and you're in program. It costs huge sums of money to incarcerate people for decades or even life for petty shoplifting. It costs billions of dollars to incarcerate and supervise huge amount of people for things that were never even violent. It costs huge amount of money to over-criminalize behavior. Disorderly conduct, for example, is a huge crime, takes up a lot of court time, especially for younger people, when some things like that can be better treated with a non-criminal ordinance. So I think if there is any hope for reform, we have to tie it to the cost of this. Our hypervigilant society comes at a high cost, money that can be used for education, money that can be used for other purposes. So I think that's the key to reform, and I also offer some specific examples of ways that we could reform, simplify, streamline our criminal justice system, protect our constitutional rights, but still not let violent criminals who are actually guilty, not letting those people go free. I think it's always important to protect society from that, and I don't think we should change that in any way.
Kenosha attorney Michael DeCicchini is the author of Tried and Convicted, How Police, Prosecutors, and Judges Destroy Our Constitutional Rights, book published by Roman and Littlefield Publishers. 8:46, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I encourage you to seek out a wonderful new show that is coming to the National Geographic Channel, and as a matter of fact, premiering tonight, a program called Abandoned. And the premise might seem unpromising because it focuses on abandoned buildings and what you find inside the four walls of abandoned buildings. Does it sound dull? I promise you it's not. It's a fascinating premise, actually. And what we do in this series is follow a carpenter and a collector by the name of Jay Chaikin. And his business, Reclaimed Relics, goes into abandoned properties and ferrets out fascinating, interesting, forgotten things. And in a sense, gives them a new lease on life. And the camera follows Jay and his crew as they enter these abandoned buildings, sometimes at their own peril, and we are right there as they uncover all kinds of unlikely treasures. Jay Chaikin is on the phone with us to talk a little bit about the work that he does and about this series, again called Abandoned, premiering Wednesday evening, the 22nd of August, on the National Geographic Channel. Jay Chaikin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, how long have you been doing this? I assume well ahead of the advent of this particular television series that this has been your line of work.
Ever since I was a kid, you know, I'd go out in the woods and find the old farmer's dumps and start digging away, and I'll tell you what, the treasures you can find, you know, I mean, another person's trash is another person's treasure.
And so, as we should explain to our listeners, you and your crew will go into these abandoned buildings, find interesting things, and at the very end of the episode, there is sort of a transaction that takes place between you and whoever owns the building. So, in a sense, you're not visiting completely abandoned properties. They are abandoned by their original owners and are no longer used in their original way. But somebody owns these buildings and the stuff inside them. And so that's kind of where all of this ultimately ends. Tell us about the search process by which you and your firm find abandoned properties to explore.
Well, I mean, a lot of times you could just be, we'll drive down the highway, you know, you see an abandoned barn, farmhouse, building, you stop in, you inquire, you know, there's a lot of things you can find out at the barbershop. You know, you stop in at a local barbershop and you start asking questions, and I'll tell you, the next thing you know is you got a lot of leads to follow.
I don't remember where your business is located. I mean, where are your headquarters?
We're in Sellersville, Pennsylvania, in Bucks County.
So I assume that most of your travels take you into that particular quadrant of the country?
I mean, we got a lot of history back here in Pennsylvania, you know. But I'll tell you what, I mean, there's some incredible places throughout the United States, and we've had the pleasure and the privilege to visit some of these mills and buildings, and trying to save some of that history that's left and get it back out there as a functional, you know, functional furniture or just something to admire.
So when you come across some kind of abandoned property that for whatever reason might seem to be promising, I suppose then you have to track down whoever owns the building and see if they will let you enter it. I mean, they need to grant you permission to enter the building and go searching for treasures. How often are the owners willing to do that?
I mean, a lot of times, more times than not, they let you in. You know, once I get talking with them and let them know what we're about. You know, I didn't get into this business because of the money. I got into it because I want to save history. You know, it tells a story. And, you know, some of these things that are inside these buildings haven't seen the daylight in 100 years, and it doesn't belong there anymore. It belongs somewhere out in the sunlight. It belongs somewhere where somebody's going to appreciate it, you know, and give it and take care of it. It is pretty amazing. I mean, sometimes you do approach somebody and when you all of a sudden you're inquiring about something, and now, you know, now they think they have something extremely valuable, and that kind of hurts you. But for the most part, once I get talking to the folks and they understand what I'm about, usually it's a go.
The program begins, that is the first episode of Abandoned, finds us following you into a very dark, abandoned church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And this turns out to be a really extraordinary adventure, and in a couple of different ways, in terms of what you are uncovering down in the dark, dank basement, and what you uncover in the still, beautiful sanctuary of the church. I thought that was one kind of interesting thing, too, that this is not just about grime and dirt, but this is sometimes about incredible beauty which you find in some of these properties.
I mean, you go into a church like this, and, you know, the sad thing is back in the day when everything was, you know, you had craftsmen that just poured their heart and soul into whatever they made, and that church is a Gothic revival. The work is amazing, stained glass. I mean, but you go into the sanctuary, and of course, you know, you see what you should see, stained glass. You see beautiful pews, you know, and but you're always there's always that you know, like you're opening a Cracker Jack box, and you just never know what you're going to find, you know. And you go into the basement, and I mean, the last thing I would expect to see in the basement of a church is a two-lane bowling alley from over 100 years ago.
Or a set of parallel bars that would be used by gymnasts in the basement of a church.
I mean, it's amazing, but then you start, you know, and for me, I start getting a visual of what this place must have looked like. It was the hub of the community. You know, not only did they pray together, but they exercised together and they played together. So, I mean, it gives you a picture of a very, very tight community. And, you know, and this was the hub of the gathering. You know, they just gathered here to do, you know, everything from pray to exercise to have fun.
Mm. And, of course, the moment when you and your crew finally are able to make your way into the sanctuary, which is locked up tight, I mean, it's a breathtaking sight, this beautiful, beautiful space. I think somebody in the film says it looks like they had church here 2 days ago. Or could have church tonight if they wanted. I mean, it was that beautiful, that untouched by the ravages of time. By contrast, the second episode of Abandon finds you exploring an abandoned factory. I mean, and nothing could be less promising than that. And to the amateur eye, we'd look through these broken windows and see nothing that would be of apparent value. Talk for a moment about the challenge. I mean, in your own expertise in finding valuable items in such unlikely places.
You know, I don't want you to think that anything it doesn't speak to me, but in a way, you know, it's kind of a gift. You can, you know, I can see items and immediately I know what I can transform them into. This episode, there's the grist mill, you know, and they ground the flour down, the wheat down, the flour. I mean, you go into this place, it's dilapidated. I mean, it's falling apart. You know, and then I get up on the second floor and I see the old millstones, and there's a hopper, you know, that the grain would have been poured through, and there's a cradle that holds the hopper. And the next thing I know is I'm staring at three, you know, cradles that I'm going to turn into coffee tables. And immediately I get the visual of what I want to turn it into. But then the next exciting thing is trying to get the owner to you know, to sell, to part with it, you know, because, I mean, this was an integral part of a working grist mill, but it's awesome to give it another life, you know, repurpose it and have it hang around for another, you know, 150 years.
We should say a word about the two guys that join you on these missions and about the woman who is, in a sense, back at the ranch. Let's talk first about the two guys who accompany you on these adventures.
Yeah, I mean, Dan's been my friend since we were little. We grew up together. We went on a couple adventures. I mean, if you can picture him and I, back in the day, they had three-wheelers. And, you know, I like to say we just couldn't afford the fourth wheel. And, you know, we'd drive out to an abandoned farm. I remember driving miles. You know, I wanted to have this old barrel. There was an old oak barrel that weighed a ton. And so just picture Dan and I, you know, on this three-wheeler that's meant for one person, and we're carrying this oak, you know, barrel for miles riding on this three-wheeler. So really, you know, it for us, for Dan and I, it started way back when. And then I met Mark through my kids play football, and, you know, he was sitting on the tailgate of his truck, and the next thing we know is we sparked up a conversation, and away we went. And he's he's scared of everything, but I'll tell you what, the guys that are with me, you know, Mark and Dan, if I got hurt, if something fell on me, you know, like Mark might be scared of his own shadow, but I'll tell you what, if something happened to me, I know he's got my back, and he would bust down walls to get to me.
And then back on the other end of the phone is your wife, your partner in the business, and she is sometimes the sobering voice of reason for you.
Most of the time, I'm the speed and she's the brakes, you know, and it works very well. Thank goodness I didn't marry somebody who liked to spend money, because we'd be bankrupt by now.
So often when you are feeling like, oh, we have to have this, I need this amount of money to buy such and such, she's the one saying, whoa, let's think about this. And it's really fun to follow the interplay between the two of you. I can't let you go without having you talk at least for a couple of minutes about one of the adventures which will occur at some point in this season, right here in our neck of the woods, when you explore an abandoned building in Milwaukee. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, my. Mark, he only drinks Pabst Blue Ribbon. And, I mean, he's a union guy. He's a sprinkler fitter, you know, by trade. And, I mean, he just believes with all his heart in union, and he drinks nothing but Pabst. And I'll tell you what, when we went there, it was like you brought him to Disney World, you know. So it was a pretty amazing adventure. I mean, we found some really neat stuff. But I'll tell you what, you know, I think Mark spent a good portion of his time trying to sneak this keg of beer out of the building. So it was pretty amazing. And I'll tell you, Mark's been smiling ever since.
Jay Chaikin and his crew are featured in the National Geographic series Abandoned. It premieres tonight on the National Geographic Channel at 8 and 8:30. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll preview for you a POV documentary, which is actually an encore presentation, a very powerful and moving film called Presumed Guilty, which examines the very corrupt criminal justice system in Mexico City through the eyes of a single man who has been unjustly arrested, charged, convicted, and sentenced to imprisonment. The film captures the desperate efforts of his attorneys to find him justice and freedom. POV rebroadcasts this documentary tomorrow night, and you'll hear my conversation with the filmmakers tomorrow. And on Friday, Wisconsin author Michael Perry, talking about his newest book, Visiting Tom. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And the program is archived on WGTD's website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Our weather forecast is for sunny skies today and a high of 83 degrees, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 62 degrees. Tomorrow, warmer than today, partly sunny skies and warming up to 93 degrees inland, a little bit cooler near the lake. A high of 89 on Friday and Saturday as well. Temperatures falling back just a little bit by the end of the weekend. 9 o'clock, this is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio.